2009. So keen sailors out there, please attend that. And all the way to April now, there's a club dinner with Sandra Tagore, who's the has a gallery in Hong Kong, New York, London, and several other places. And he is going to talk about the promise of modernism, Indian art from 1900 to 2000. And we all know the art market's pretty hot these days. Today, our speaker that I'm very proud to present is Muhammad Hanif, and he is entitled his speak from the Pakistani Air Force to journalism, which seems to be more or less a strange journey to take, and I hope he'll share how that happened to him with us. He's here at the invitation of the Man Hong Kong Literary Festival, and he is now living in Karachi, but he had 11 years with his family in London. So he's probably a very accomplished English writer. His first novel, which is purchasable in this room as you leave, if you have a Dimex card, you get a discount, called A Case of Exploding Mangoes, which examines conspiracy theories and all sorts of other things. And it was longlisted for the 2008 Man Booker Prize. He's also pursued a successful career in journalism and has since written a critically acclaimed BBC drama and the feature film called The Long Night. He started his career in the Pakistani Air Force Academy as a training pilot before bailing out to pursue his successful career in journalism. So please give a warm welcome to Muhammad Hanif.
Hello. Hi. Thanks for coming. I've never done one of these, so it seems a bit rude kind of talking to people who are trying to have a very nice lunch. But I will give it a go. And I've also never... I've done book readings, and I've talked about, you know, sort of other political subjects. I've never talked about my own life because I kind of always believe that people who write, especially people who write novels, they have incredibly dull lives. You know, otherwise, why would they sit in a corner and make up stories to amuse themselves and then hope that somebody would buy them? But since I've written this book, and I have to sell some copies, so I'll try and sex up my life so that you're intrigued and you want to read my book. I was born in Pakistan, in Pakistani Punjab, in a small village in central Punjab, in a district called Okada. The village was called 2x4L. Now, why would village have a number as its name rather than a proper name as most villages have? Because the British made these canals, and they populated that area where I come from. So the villages on the left side of the canal were all called something L, and on the right side of the canal all called R. So I was, I happened to be born in a place called 2x4L. My family were farmers, potato farmers. I went to a school there in my village. My mother tongue was Punjabi, so I spent like the first kind of, you know, 8-9 years of my education trying to learn Urdu because the medium of instruction in Pakistan was at that time Urdu. And then at that time the career options were you could become a potato farmer, who could be incredibly enterprising, you know, study really hard and become a doctor. Which I wasn't kind of interested in. I did help out the family farm, and although it's I still find it quite a fascinating process, potato farming and how the potato economy works. But I wasn't really good at it. So like those people, I just wanted to get away from that village and go to a city or someplace, anywhere outside that village. So I saw this newspaper when I had just done my high school and saw an advert where this, like, you know, sort of tall, glamorous guy was flying in sort of F-16 type aircraft. And when you're 16, you know, in Pakistan at least, or in my time, you always wanted to either become a pilot or a cricketer or a pop star. Since the other options weren't there, so I applied for this Air Force Academy thing. And I was really surprised that I got in. So off I was sent to the Air Force Academy, and as soon as I walked into those doors and looked behind, I realized that this wasn't the place for me. My first reaction was, what have you done to yourself? But I was there for 7 years. I studied, I kind of learned to fly. I did all the things that trainee soldiers do. I got into a bit of trouble from time to time. And then we got to the flying stage where you learn to fly, and first you learn on these slow propeller planes, which were all right, which were okay. And then as soon as we moved to jets, which are very, very fast, and I didn't even know how to drive before that. I did know how to bike, but I'd never kind of driven a car. And I might have driven a tractor once or twice with, like, you know, some older uncle, but I didn't. And I just felt very, very sick at the sheer speed of it. And I was very generally very bad at flying. I was kind of, you know, a risk to myself and the neighboring kind of population in that where our academy was. So after about 7 years of being in the Air Force, I left. It's really difficult to get out of the Air Force because they've paid for your education. They've, you know, sort of, it's like having a job. And they make you sign this 18-year-long contract. So I wrote these long kind of sob stories about how my family needs me and how, you know, sort of how things are really bad in the village and I need to go back. Please, please let me go. And apparently my sort of application was so impressive that the commandant said, yes, let him go. So, and then I didn't know what I was going to do next because the Army or the Air Force life doesn't really equip you for anything, or at least in Pakistan, it doesn't. So I had like no clue, and I had not seen since from the age of 16. I had been in the cantonment areas in the Air Force academies, and you know, sort of an odd weekend out there. So I had no idea what the civilian world was like, what people did, how they found jobs, how they made living, how they met girls. So I was incredibly kind of lost. But the time that I'd spent in the Air Force, I'd somehow got interested into reading and writing little bits for college magazines or just doing my friends' assignments or, you know, stuff like that. So that was one thing that I kind of vaguely knew that I might do. So I started freelancing, you know, sort of I started writing for a magazine called Glamour, which was very glamorous. I got to interview kind of fashion models and, you know, sort of TV stars. And I said, God, this is a life. This is what I want to do. But after like about 6-8 months, I realized, my God, this is not real journalism. This is just like, you know, sort of just printing these, like, you know, sort of incredibly pretty pictures and writing, like, you know, sort of these silly captions that you might have seen in fashion magazines. So then I started doing bits of kind of other stuff that people weren't doing at that time, or at least fashion magazines weren't doing. And then I got a call from this incredible woman in Karachi who just started a new current affairs magazine called Newsline. It was the first Pakistani magazine, which was a small but independent magazine owned by journalists. So it was a really small team. And she kind of got the job as an editorial assistant because she thought I was very good at giving picture captions and had headlines. But then from there, I became a reporter, and I kind of, in those days, you had a sort of a lot of urban violence in Karachi, and kind of, you know, you had all these fascistic political parties coming up. So it was really interesting time. So mostly I wrote about violence and politics, and then drug trafficking was quite big in Pakistan. So I traveled to far off places, did all of that. While I was doing that, I also kind of made friends with wannabe actors who wanted to put up plays but didn't have a script. So, you know, I wrote a couple of stage plays for them, at least. One of these was a minor hit in Karachi. It got really great reviews and you know, sort of a houseful type of scenario. So I did that, and then I was still doing journalism. You know, so that was my bread and butter. Then I also wrote a film, which in Urdu was called Raat Chali Hai Jhoomke. I don't know how it became The Long Night, and it's with subtitles. It did the usual kind of festival circuit. There's not much that I can say about it. It was probably a rip-off from a Hollywood film, and I don't even know which film I ripped off. So every time I have to kind of I face these questions. So is it inspired by that film? And I always say yes, probably it is. But I've really forgotten what inspired me. Then I saw another advert in a newspaper. It was for a BBC job. And I had just gotten married, and at that time it seemed like a really good idea to go live in London. So I applied for that job, and I got it. So I moved to London. We had initially planned that we'll go there for 3 years. But before we knew, kind of, it was 10 years. So we've just moved back about 8 months ago, back to Karachi. While I was there, I was still doing bits of theater and, you know, sort of did a radio play. But increasingly, because writing plays and making films is really a collaborative kind of thing. You're dependent on, you know, sort of directors, actors. And when it works, it's really good fun. I mean, I don't think there's any better feeling than for somebody who tries to write, is sitting in a theater and, you know, sort of and see kind of, you know, actors enact what, you know, sort of whatever, you know, whatever you've written. But when it doesn't work, then it's bizarre, because everybody blames everyone else. It's like, you know, the director thinks that, oh, actually the script was completely crap, and the actors think that nobody directed us properly, and, you know, sort of everybody thinks that the world is like, you know, not very nice place. Why isn't this? So then I must have had this idea that maybe I should try and write a book, because that's where you can't blame anyone. You just sit in a corner and you do your own thing. So that's how I wrote this book. It's called A Case of Exploding Mangoes. We can talk more about it in our Q&A session. So this book came out last year. After that, I've moved back to Pakistan, where I work as a special correspondent for BBC's Urdu service. I also do sort of stuff for various BBC outlines, and me and Bonnie, we were just talking about that BBC is sitting very pretty because it's publicly funded, whereas the other foreign correspondents who work for like various newspapers and TV channels, they're probably not they don't feel that secure, and nobody kind of knows what's going to happen. And we were also talking about blogs and what are these called now, people who kind of are not journalists, but, you know, sort of, they write their blogs. And then all the news organizations have also kind of hopped onto this bandwagon where you have people's journalists kind of, you know, writing in and, you know, sort of just doing their rants, and they get published, like, on websites and in newspapers, and every TV channel you switch on, there is, like, you know, sort of segments like I Report and I Do This. So it's all about empowering people. But a very senior editor recently said something very nice, which was like, you know, do you want people's journalists? Like, why not people's surgeons? Why not people's train drivers? Like, you know, what about that? Since when did journalism became something that anybody could, you know, sort of get up and do? So now I live in Pakistan, and some of you might have questions about what's Pakistan like these days? What goes on in Pakistan? Well, I have very little idea myself. But probably some of you know about cricket, what, you know, sort of cricket is. I think Hong Kong used to have a team, or still probably has a team, which was an associate member of whatever the thing is. So I think last week, about 10 days ago, there was an attack in Lahore on Sri Lankan team, which is something that's never happened in Pakistan before. One kind of tends to think, if one is not living in Pakistan, that anything, you know, can happen in Pakistan. But this was something that people thought would never happen. I wrote a little piece about it, so I'll just finish with this piece, and then we can, you know, sort of, we can talk, you can ask me anything that you guys want to. This I wrote last week, and it's just be patient, it's like only 3 minutes long or something. Do you think the Taliban might ban cricket? I asked a class 8 student in Mangora, the main city in Pakistan, Swat Valley, last week. The schools had reopened after the government reached a ceasefire deal with the local Taliban, who had banned girls from attending schools and blown up more than 200 school buildings. As I visited various schools and markets, all the hallmarks of Taliban rule were visible there. The trouser shirt school uniform had been replaced by shalwar kameez dresses. Girls in fourth grade had turned up in elaborate black head covers. Girl students in high schools and female teachers wore burqas. All the music shops had been shut down. Barbers had hung no shaves and no un-Islamic haircut signs outside their doors. The class 8 student, who had just given me a very articulate critique of the Taliban's approach to Islam, seemed baffled at my question. Why would they do that, he asked me. I reminded him of the Taliban's ban on all kinds of entertainment, music, movies, even advertising billboards. But cricket is just a sport, he said. It's good for your body. The student in Mangora was not alone in his bafflement when more than a dozen militants targeted the visiting Sri Lankan team in the heart of Lahore last week. Pakistanis had come to believe that the game of cricket was above all the bloody battles raging in Pakistan. In the past 2 years, militants have blown up mosques, attacked five-star hotels, and opened fire on school buses carrying children. But cricket in Pakistan was considered a religion above religion, not just a favorite pastime or passion, as many observers have pointed out, but almost a spiritual obsession. Devout family members cut their prayers short so that they do not have to miss a single ball being bowled in a cricket match. Last year, I had a reunion with a long-lost friend who spent the entire evening glued to his television screen watching a 2020 match and started talking after the game was over. I have had conversations with the celebrated Pakistani writer Mohsin Hamid, where he has explained everything from the current literary trends to world politics in cricketing terms. One of Pakistan's most famous pop singers almost broke down in tears recently when he confessed to me that as a teenager he wanted to make it to the national cricket team, and his pop stardom was no consolation. The love for cricket in Pakistan cuts across all ethnic and class divides. On any given weekend or public holiday, streets and bylanes of Pakistan's cities turn into cricket pitches. Grown-up, bearded men play cricket on Karachi beaches using a disused shoe as a bat. I still remember the sparkle in children's eyes in Pakistani-administered Kashmir when, after the devastating earthquake, relief workers distributed bats and balls. I'm myself a lapsed cricket fan and can only be bothered to pay attention if a match is heading towards a nail-biting finish. But even I considered it my parental duty to take my son to Qaddafi Stadium to see an India-Pakistan match during the last tour. He was awestruck by the electric atmosphere and was soon chanting and waving without understanding either the game or the slogans. Last Tuesday, as I watched the images of young men barely out of their teens, wearing white sneakers, carrying backpacks, shooting and running around the green patch just outside Qaddafi Stadium, I called up a friend to share the news. She said with genuine sadness, the match has been cancelled. I was struck how she was concerned about not being able to follow the game amidst all the mayhem unfolding on the screens. As I watched the live coverage of the events on Pakistani television channels, my friend's sentiments were echoed by various journalists. The dead policemen were lionized. The bus driver who had managed to race away under the hail of bullets was declared a national hero. But the centerpiece of the coverage was cricket. What team would dare to visit Pakistan after this? Was this the end of international cricket for Pakistan? What about the Cricket World Cup 2001, which Pakistan was supposed to co-host with other countries from the subcontinent? There were also suggestions that this was revenge for the Mumbai attacks. Some TV channels ran split-screen footage of the Mumbai and Lahore attacks to prove their point. For me, there were other chilling parallels. There were 12 attackers, the size of a cricket team plus 12th man. Their performance on the green patch outside Gaddafi Stadium involved nifty footwork and great coordination. And like good cricketers, they kept their heads down and went about their business with efficiently and with flair. It is almost certain that no international cricket team will play in Pakistan for the foreseeable future. But I wonder how many kids watching these cricketers, these attackers in action, might think that playing Rambo in front of a world audience is more fun than a game of street cricket. Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much for a riveting speech. Everybody, I'm sure, has questions. I forgot to remind you to turn off your phones and your pagers if you haven't done so. I'm happy to take questions from the audience. Pakistan being in the news so often these days. Well, perhaps I'll start with a question. In the case of the exploding mangoes, it's deeply involved with conspiracy theories. So what sort of prompted you to write about such things?
Well, I sort of grew up during the 80s, and General Zia was, he ruled Pakistan while I was growing up. And it seemed like it does with most dictators, that he was never going to go away. And one fine day, we sort of woke up, and we heard the news that his plane had just exploded. It took off from an airbase, like in 4 minutes later. It just exploded in midair, and a nation rejoiced. People were dancing on the streets. And obviously, I forgot about it. Not only I forgot about it, but the whole nation forgot about it. Even the institution that he headed, there were like 6-8 top generals who died with him. There was the US ambassador who died with him. But everybody seemed to have forgotten. It was like one of those things that, oh, good riddance, let's move on. Let's not think who might have done it. So when you don't have any real information and sort of a proper investigation, people start coming up with these theories, which sometimes, you know, sort of are much more fun than the truth, because you'll never know. As a journalist, I did try to investigate a couple of times whether, you know, what might have happened. But there were layers and layers and layers of disinformation, and nobody kind of, you know, sort of talked. Even his own family didn't seem sort of very interested in finding out that who might have bumped him off. So I just thought that there's a, and I've been interested kind of, you know, in murder mysteries. So I just thought that there's a ready-made kind of template for a murder mystery. So it was a kind of lazy writer's idea of writing a novel, because the plot in a way already existed, or I knew what was going to happen in the end. I just had to do the rest of the work.
Well, I do think there are a lot of conspiracy theories around about a lot of things. Of course, the U.S. is famous for who killed John Kennedy. We still don't know if we're ever going to get an answer to that one. And of course, 9/11 2001 is another one where there's just so many crazy theories about it that it's disheartening, but I guess it's human nature, basically, to make up stories in a vacuum of true information. Yes, in the back.
What is the cultural life like in Karachi, particularly after London?
Microphone.
Oh, sorry. Okay. What's the cultural life?
Please identify yourself when you speak. Thank you.
I'm Dennis Firth. What is the cultural life in Karachi like, particularly in comparison to London? Thank you.
Karachi rocks, but I don't know how long it will last. I mean, there was a film festival, there's a theater festival on right now, and you know, sort of, there's like with rich people, there's a party like in every third house every, you know, sort of weekend. But Karachi is also kind of quite secluded. It's not representative of the rest of the country. So at the moment, there's a city festival going on. There are like stage plays on the beach, and you know, sort of, there's always something going on. Obviously, there could be more things, there could be better things. But Karachi, I must tell you, is not the all of Pakistan. I mean, what I was just in Sawat Valley, where I'd written this, where this piece actually starts. So this is a town which was a tourist town. So it was very, very liberal till a few years ago, because if your economy is tourist-driven, you cannot, like, you know, sort of bother about things like if somebody's walking around in shorts or if somebody's, you know. But I met, and there were about 500 music shops, music and DVD shops. They've all been shut. There used to be these kind of dancers. They've all moved out after one of them was dragged out of her house and shot dead in the main city square. All the musicians have moved to other parts of Pakistan. So that part is a bit scary. Karachi is, as I said, you know, sort of people don't seem to think that something will happen here, but from what I can tell, you know, sort of, things are kind of slowly creeping in from the north towards south.
At the end of the table there, yeah.
Chris Spotsford, how much has the sort of growth of the Taliban influenced your own writing and caused you to edit what you write for your own safety?
Well, I wrote my book when I was in London. So, you know, Taliban was just one of those news stories that you cover every day, and you kind of, you know, you forget about it. You kind of, you know. But now, no, it hasn't. I don't think I have. But if I was living, you know, sort of in an area controlled by Taliban, I don't know what I would do then. I mean, they've just 3 days before I was there, they, you know, sort of killed this local journalist who was reporting for, like, you know, sort of one of the biggest TV channels in Pakistan. And he was very cautious. It's not that he was making some outrageous statements. He was doing, like, bread and butter reporting that so many people have been killed today, and Taliban spokesperson has said this, and the army spokesperson has said this. So he was doing, like, really kind of, you know, just basic factual journalism, but he was shot dead. But since I don't live there, I don't have to censor myself. And in fact, in Pakistan, I kind of, you know, tend to go on about this, that actually more than ever, this is the time where people have to kind of, you know, speak up and say, you know, sort of what they feel about it, because in mainstream press, for some strange reason, you'll always find people who, if they're not cheerleaders for these people, they're kind of apologists. They'll, like, you know, always find, you know, sort of an excuse that, oh, well, since America did this and since India has done this in Kashmir, it's a fucked up logic, basically. But they kind of, and you'll have these people on mainstream newspapers and mainstream media doing that, and I very strongly feel, and I'm sure there are some other journalists in Pakistan who feel very strongly that that this is the time to kind of, you know, to speak up and write what you think is, you know, sort of needs to be written.
I saw a hand on this table. Yes, ma'am. And then next, back in the back.
Okay, going, Sue Khan. Going back to General Zia, his murder was never solved. In recent years, there have been many murders, both individual and on a mass scale by terrorists, and they're not solved. Is Pakistan institutionally unwilling or incapable, probably with ISI assistance, of solving these issues? We'll never get to the bottom of them, I think.
I don't know, in South Asia we've had this, like, you know, long history of these political assassinations, like right from Gandhi to Indira Gandhi to Bandra Naike to Bhutto, who everybody now says was actually assassinated. It was a judicial murder, to the last one, who was Benazir Bhutto, and people kind of always tend to suggest that since you wrote about one assassination, now will you write about Benazir Bhutto or somebody else? And one could actually start like a sort of a whole mini industry just by writing books about all the people who've been killed in South Asia, and the murders which have never been explained. I think you're right. In sort of, when was it? In 1951 or something, just after the partition, Pakistan's first prime minister was assassinated in a place called Liaquat Bagh in Rawalpindi. It was never solved. And 60-some years later, the same place, Benazir Bhutto was killed, and, you know, sort of anybody who knows even a little bit about Pakistan can say it with certainty that it will probably never be solved. So there wasn't... I don't think ISI was that big when Liaquat Ali Khan was killed. I am not even sure if it existed. So it might be something even more sinister. It might be one of those family killings where a family kind of colludes, you know, that somebody is killed and then everybody actively or passively sort of colludes in the cover-up. So I think probably, yes, ISI is one major factor, but probably there might be more things.
Yes, in the back there, thank you.
Returning to the earlier conversation about returning to Pakistan, so I was just curious, you didn't tell us why you decided to move back, especially the context is what's currently going on. I mean, was it patriotism, journalistic duty, potato farming? What led you back?
I think cheap domestic help, basically. I mean, I don't know. I find that question always odd. I mean, I went from Karachi. Karachi is home. Why won't I go back there? I mean, you know, sort of not going back would be, you know, sort of might be a question which one. So, no, we basically, like most expats who, when they're going somewhere, they say that, oh, I have a 3-year contract and, you know, sort of I'm storing my furniture here. Like, you know, you keep my TV. I'll be back and collect. And then something happens, like, you know, you're kind of a bit lazy or something interesting comes up at work or you get offered a little bit more salary and then you kind of say, oh, maybe we should buy this house and, you know, and then next year you think, oh, maybe we should redo the kitchen or banal things like that. And then you have a kid and he's going to school and he has friends and everything becomes really complicated. And we're the kind of people who every year... we used to visit Pakistan quite frequently. Every year we'd tell our family and friends, oh, next year we're definitely coming back. What should we do? Where should we get a house? I mean, and people actually started making fun of us. He said, like, you know, there were these annoying smiles. Oh, we've heard this before. Now shut up. So I think there was a bit of that you sometimes you just want to prove people wrong. I mean, it's a really silly kind of way of going about your life. But I think there was a bit of that. My son was also kind of 10 years old. And practically, I think we've heard that it becomes much more difficult when, you know, sort of they're teenagers to move to another country, to sort of move to another culture. So all these kind of things contributed. We didn't really think about what the conditions were in Pakistan. And to tell you the truth, Karachi is still the same, like, you know, as it was 11 years ago. I'm not sure if that answers your question, but there wasn't like one single reason. I mean, if there was one single reason, it was the fact that when we were going away, we'd said, oh, we'll be back very soon.
I think a lot of us expats feel that way. Other questions? Yes, right here.
My name is Balakrishnan. Unlike in Iran, there doesn't seem to be a populist Islamic upsurge in Pakistan. During elections, Islamic parties always get very few seats.
You're so right, yeah.
And then why is it that no politician doesn't seem to be galvanized the anti-fundamentalist sentiment and translate into political power?
Huh. I mean, that's a really, really very valid question. I wish I had the answer to it, because it is completely true. Whenever we've had, like, even semi-decent elections, like the last election, people have never voted for any of the religious parties. And that's true across the country. Like, even in Sawat Valley, where Taliban have taken over now, almost, after this peace deal with the government, people voted for a party called Awami National Party, ANP, which is kind of, you know, if you look at its manifesto, it looks really retro, socialist, Gandhian kind of, you know, secular manifesto. People voted for that party. But now people have got Taliban. So what has happened, I think, in parts of Pakistan, and the danger is that it's spreading, that there has been this militarization of large kind of, you know, so if there is a population of 5,000 and 10 of them, you know, sort of have AK-47s and endless supply of ammunition and a very, you know, sort of narrow, fucked-up agenda, it's very likely that they will win. They will, you know, sort of, if the government or the army kind of, you know, doesn't intervene 100%. So that is what has happened in Pakistan. I like to believe, and I also like to believe that I'm right, that there is actually no populist kind of, you know, support for these things in Pakistan. And I always argue, somebody like, you know, sort of in Punjab, in my own village that I was telling you about already, then you get these people who, since we've lived under military dictatorship, and they've only seen Taliban from like a distance, and you're saying, oh, they give you instant justice, and that's what the society needs. Like, you know, we need justice because our justice system is really fucked up. And I was telling him, look, you take your girls to school in the morning. I mean, I've just seen them. They've blown up their schools. They don't want girls to go to school. And I'm saying, oh no, they won't be able to do it here because that's not Punjabi culture. It has something to do with the Sawati culture. And I was like, you know, if they had like 200 schools in this little area, it wasn't their culture. If they had 500 music shops in this little town, that means that they were listening to music because this was a very good business. So it wasn't their culture. So as I said, that, you know, sort of the distant, the slight distance that you have from these things, you think that, oh, it won't happen to us. We won't do this. So, and there are actually no politicians who can actually take it up as a sort of, you know, as the most pressing kind of threat to Pakistan. So yeah, we kind of lack that.
Okay, in the back there, thank you.
My name is Patel. Just what are your thoughts about relationship between India and Pakistan?
I don't know. I think we should have like, you know, very good relations with India, and I think India should also realize that there might be this problem in Pakistan right now, but it won't stay in Pakistan, as has been proved recently, that it will cross border. It will hurt them as much as it is hurting Pakistan. So sometimes I feel we're like two sort of one of those neighbors, you know, those traditional kind of rivals who kind of, you know, if somebody buys a TV, then the other one has to get a bigger TV. And then, you know, sort of, and if somebody's sending one to their child to the school, and then they have to kind of, you know. So we've had this history of upmanship for a very long time. I don't think Pakistani citizens are interested in that anymore, because within Pakistan we have such a huge mess that nobody thinks about going to war with India as we used to, like, you know, all these years. I don't think that realization exists in India. I've been to India like recently, like, you know, thrice at least, and in the last few months. I don't think that realization exists. There's also a bit of when in that sort of whole rival neighbor narrative, there's also a bit of smugness that look how fucked up my neighbor is and look how sorted I am. So I think that is also, again, cannot last. If Pakistan, if what's happening in Pakistan, I mean, any person with an average intelligence can tell you that if it's not stopped, if it's not dealt with, it's not going to stop at Wagah. It hasn't stopped at Wagah. There are kind of, you know. So I think Pakistan and India, sort of more than any other time in history, they should, you know, sort of, they should get together now and make it a common cause. Otherwise, you know, sort of, otherwise we'll both, and Pakistan is already in trouble. India seems quite smug that, okay, there's like this odd incident in Mumbai, and then this kind of, which shakes them a little bit. But it won't, I'm afraid it won't stop, you know, sort of the Pakistani borders.
I'm sorry, sir, I hadn't seen you. Okay, in the back there, please. One more question. No, I mean, the lady had her hand up before you. Thank you. And then you go next. And that may be our last question. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Mavish Ahmed. And Yves Saab, just wanted to bring the discussion a bit back to the case of exploding mangoes. And I just wanted.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. That's why I'm here. I'm not here to resolve India-Pakistan problems. Sorry.
We can multitask. We can do all of those things. I just wanted to say thank you for this book. Everyone I've spoken to who has read this book has been touched by it, and I don't mean that in some sort of pseudo-sentimental way, but I think, like you said, you knew the ending before you began writing the book. So the book is really about the people that you're writing about. And I think the characterization is brilliant. I'm an academic, and I'm supposed to be researching that part, that era in Pakistan academically, but I just can't get your portrait of Zia out of my head when I'm trying to do academic writing.
It's all made up. Don't quote me on it.
Uh-oh. So I was actually going to ask you, you know, what resource did you tap? How did you come up with this characterization of someone who was actually the most powerful man in Pakistan at that time, and he's caricatured brilliantly in your book, and I just want to know how you did that.
I don't know. I think you had your. I had my memory, of course. I kind of did you grow up during the 80s? Yeah. So anybody who was around at that time kind of remembers this man droning on and on and on. We used to be jokes that there's this guy whose face is stuck in TV and there's nothing anybody can do. So there was that presence. And obviously you didn't remember what he used to say because it was all kind of bullshit. But when I was writing this book, I did buy like all the kind of texts in Urdu mostly that were available about him and about his period and about his life. And they were mostly written by people who were his cronies, basically, people who, like, you know, retired generals and bureaucrats. And if you read them, he comes across as this really humble, God-fearing kind of man, and nothing interesting ever happens to him. And that's obviously no use to somebody who's trying to write a novel. Like, you know, why would you create a character like that? And since I came from journalism, so there's a part of your mind which is always worried about what the other journalists are going to say. They're going to say, like, you know, this thing didn't happen, like, you know, in that year. Or I met him, he wasn't like that. So at some point I had to convince myself that I'm, you know, writing a novel. I don't have to adhere to BBC editorial guidelines. I can do whatever I want. And that was like, you know, I could, you know, just walk into his bedroom and see what was going on there rather than, you know, sort of relying on some, you know, sort of actually kind of false biographical details which are kind of, you know, which were floating around. So that was, I think, the main. And after that, I think I felt a bit free to do whatever I wanted to do with him. Before that, I went through this struggle where I was trying to keep him or at least the trying to keep the timeline real and worrying about stuff like whether he was there on that day or not there on that day. So after I stopped worrying about that, after I realized that this is not General Zia who we used to see on TV, and this is like a fictional character. So after that, I started having a bit of fun with him.
Wonderful question, thank you. And our last question, that gentleman, please.
Fantastic read.
Thanks.
It's a dark book, but I don't think anybody has alluded to the fact that when you read it, you laugh a lot. And my question is going to be in that area. We've perhaps under sort of represented that here with all the political stuff, but it's funny. And there's a pliancy with how you approach these tough topics. And like I said, it's humorously written.
I didn't really think about it while I was writing it, because you don't think about such things. You're just trying to, you're trying to keep the things going, so that you yourself,
I actually do have a question.
Okay.
And then I'll leave it to you. But the silent drill team, mm-hmm. that captured my imagination. Can you talk something about that?
It captured my imagination too. That's why I wrote about it. No, I was never in the team or anything. I was far too clumsy for that kind of thing. I didn't remember. I vaguely remember that there used to be something like this in Pakistan. And then, and then I remembered, where did it come from? And I couldn't remember, because a drill is, it was like one of those stupid challenges that writers, when they're struggling, they set themselves up that, okay, I'm going to write this scene. Now, a drill is like a very mechanical kind of thing. Nothing, worth writing or interesting happens in it. So that's how I started thinking about it, that the military, all militaries do drills. Yeah, I remember bits of like how this used to work. But is there a way that I could write about it? And of course, I didn't remember at all what the ritual was, how it worked and how it didn't work. So I obviously went to to YouTube and looked up all these videos of US Marines doing this drill, because they have a special silent drill squad which goes from city to city doing this silly routine. So I just watched it a couple of times, then tried to forget about it and wrote what I wanted to write. Yeah. That answer your question. Yeah. 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 Thanks.
Sorry, I turned up my microphone. I thank you all very much for attending today, and please allow me to apologize to the other sponsor, the Asian Literary Review, of this wonderful man, Hong Kong International Man Literary Festival, and I really appreciate you all being here. And before our guest can escape, he is going to be given one of the inevitable FCC gifts.
Oh, wow.
Thank you very much for coming.
Thanks a lot. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thanks a lot. We survived. Yeah, no.